How many people here have taken a philosophy course? Wow, I'm impressed.
I'm in trouble.
You want to cancel? Well, I have never taken a formal philosophy course, but I did receive one when at 16 years old I read the book Atlas Shrugged. I didn't even know it, but I was taking a philosophy course. And I can't say it really changed my life, because I really had no certain direction in life at 16 years old yet, but I know for a fact that it influenced my life, and it influenced my business after that. It was about 10 years ago or so, actually it was probably November of 2008, when I took a renewed interest in philosophy and the direction that the country was going. And I started to go back and I reread Atlas Shrugged, then went on to The Fountainhead, and then went on to some nonfiction work and read some other people's philosophies. And I started to observe the world, and I saw that whenever my side, the side I thought I was on, would compromise legislatively, we were going in the wrong direction. And I studied the situation, and I learned that it was probably due to the fact that we didn't have an opposing philosophy that was so clearly articulated by those that were taking us in what I considered the wrong direction. Tonight I've asked Dr. Crook to speak on that subject. And the title of this speech is The Individual Versus the Collective, Opposing Philosophies. I have Dr. Brooks' bio here. It's an impressive one that I want to read. I forgot it for my employees, and he had to recount it. He did pretty good. Follow along very well. But Yaron Brook is the executive chairman of the Ayn Rand Institute. He wears many hats at the Institute and travels extensively as ARI's spokesman. Recently, I followed him from Mongolia to Azerbaijan to Israel to even France. Brook can be heard weekly on the Yaron Brook Show, which airs live on Blog Talk Radio podcast. He is also a frequent guest on national radio and television programs. An internationally sought-after speaker and debater, Brook also pens works that make one think. Brook has teamed with co-author Don Watkins in the national bestseller Free Market Revolution: How Ayn Rand's Ideas Can End Big Government. Last year, Brook and Watkins released a new book, Equal is Unfair, America's Misguided Fight Against Income Inequality. Continuing the collaboration, in the last month, in fact only weeks ago I believe, Brook and Watkins released yet another book, In Pursuit of Wealth, The Moral Case for Finance. Should be of interest, special interest to a few people in the group here. Brook is also contributing author to Neoconservatism, An Obituary for an Idea, Winning the Unwinnable War, America's Self-Crippled Response to Islamic Totalitarianism, and Big Tent, The Story of the Conservative Revolution. He was a columnist at Forbes.com, and his articles have been featured in the Wall Street Journal, USA Today, Investors Business Daily, and many other publications. Brook was born and raised in Israel. He served as a first sergeant in the Israeli military intelligence and earned a Bachelor of Science degree in civil engineering from Technion, Israel Institute of Technology in Haifa. In 1987, he moved to the United States, where he received his MBA and PhD in finance from the University of Texas at Austin. He became an American citizen in 2003. For 7 years, he was an award-winning finance professor at Santa Clara University. And in 1998, he co-founded BH Equity Research, a private equity and hedge fund manager, of which he is managing founder and director. Brooks serves on the boards of the Ayn Rand Institute, the Clemson Institute for the Study of Capitalism, and the Center for Excellence in Higher Education, and he is a member of the Association of Private Enterprise Education and the Montpelier Society. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Brooks.
Thank you. It's good to be back in Minnesota, and thank you all for coming out this evening and being here. So I want to talk about, the talk's about individualism versus collectivism, but I really want to talk about America. And because I feel like our idea of America, the idea of what America stands for and what America represents, is very much slipping away from us. People don't have a sense of what it is we are talking about when we talk about America. What is, indeed, American exceptionalism? What makes America different, if anything, anymore? So what made America different? What was the American Revolution about? What was the founding of America about? What is the fundamental idea behind America? Is America different than any other state? I believe it is. Ayn Rand believed it was. She actually called America the only, in its founding, the only moral country in human history in its founding. But why is it? What is it about America that would be perceived, or should be perceived, as moral? And are we that still, is really the question. What is America? What was the core of its founding? If you think about it, before the American Revolution, who did your life, people at the time's life, belong to? How did they think about who their life belonged to? Who did it belong to? Real question.
Subjects of the king?
Yeah, the king. Yeah. Some place didn't have kings, and then it belonged to whom? The tribal leader, the council, the pope, the community, the tribe, the fill in the blank. Right? Your life belonged to somebody, some group out there, some entity out there. And you know, nobody ever really said, well, it belongs to this particular person. It usually was, your life belonged to the tribe. Define tribe any way you want. It belonged to England, as represented by the king. It belonged to a collective. Your life as an individual was worthless. You were meant to serve. Serve the greater good. The greater good of fill in the blank. And the further back you go in history, you see this continuously, almost throughout all of history, maybe with the exception of a certain period in ancient Greece. In almost every society on earth, the lives of individual human beings were perceived to be just cogs in a collective machine, just a piece of a tribe, a piece of a group, and that you gain value from being a member of a particular group. For the first time in human history, men stood up and said, no, my life is mine. It belongs to me. You don't get to tell me what to do. You don't get to run my life. You don't get to dictate what I should think, what I should write, what I should say, how I should behave, how I should act. I get to make that decision. Now, we now take that somewhat for granted, but this was the first time in human history. Never before in all the hundreds of thousands or millions of years human beings have been on this planet has a political entity come about where people have said, we've created this political entity for the sole purpose of protecting my ability to live my life as I see fit. The reason the American government was created was to protect our rights as individuals. Now, this whole idea of the individual owning his own life, of the individual as having rights, was even to the founders a relatively new idea. There's no idea, concept of individual rights before, I don't know, 1700. That's only 76 years before the founding of America. And really, to articulate the conception of individual rights that the founders understood, it was John Locke, the great Scottish philosopher. Before that, again, your life didn't mean anything. It was part of the group. Suddenly, people changed their mind. What caused them to change their mind? Why did suddenly the individual gain value when he had no value previously or had very little value previously? What changed? Well, what changed, I think, was a discovery of the ideas of those Greeks who, for a moment in history, a long, long time ago, had this new conception. What the Greeks discovered a long time ago, and somewhat we all forgot for hundreds of years, is the nature of the human being. What is it that makes us unique as human beings? Don't say thumbs. That's what they say at the University of Minnesota, maybe, but we shouldn't say that. What makes human beings human beings? What makes us special? What makes us different than all other animals? Yeah, reason. Our capacity to reason. Our capacity to think. Our capacity to observe reality, but not just react to it instinctually, but actually integrate the information, learn from it, analyze it, think about it, create abstractions, communicate, innovate, create, build, make, but all are product of reason, of the ability to think. Aristotle defined man as the rational being. So it is our reason, our rational capacity. Knowledge, according to Aristotle, comes from reason, from observing reality. Plato, since we're doing philosophy, right? Where did knowledge come from? For Plato. So some kind of revelation, right? And only philosophers have it. Like we all, if you've ever read Plato, we all live in a cave, and all we see are shadows. And the philosophers get to go outside the cave and they get to see the sun. And that's real knowledge. And then they can come back into the cave and teach us about the real knowledge. But we never get to leave the cave. We're too dumb in some sense, right? We need philosophers to guide us. We need philosopher kings who are authorities to tell us how life needs to be lived. Because we don't have the reasoning capacity. And for Plato, it's not really reason. There's another world out there that only the philosophers can somehow observe. Think about that. If Plato's right, if you need these philosophers to observe the world, to tell us what the truth is, because we don't know it and cannot know it, what kind of political system does that lead to? What kind of conception of the individual does that lead to? Well, it leads to the perception of the individual doesn't matter. Because he doesn't know the truth. He can't observe reality. The only people who matter are who? Who are the only people who matter? The philosophers. And in the Republic, the philosopher kings, in Plato's Republic, the philosopher kings run our lives. They determine who we marry, what profession we have. Everything is dictated from the top. Aristotle comes around and says, oh, wait a minute, that's just not true. There is no other dimension. There is no somewhere where there's truth. Truth is right here in front of us. And we can observe it and discover it. But nobody took Aristotle seriously. And what we got was political systems. Once Athenian democracy disappeared, political systems that were platonic. You had a king, you had a pope, you had rulers who told us how to live and what to do because, well, we were too incompetent to know any better. And we didn't rebel because who are we? We're nothing. And then in the late 17th century, early 18th century, well, earlier than that, people rediscover Aristotle, but what happens during there is this guy by the name of Isaac Newton comes around. And Isaac Newton shows us that we can understand the world, the physical motions of objects, with simple mathematical equations that pretty much everybody can understand. You don't need philosopher kings to explain the world. Now, if you didn't understand Newton's three laws of motion, right, in physics class, it's because you had a lousy teacher. They're not hard. Anybody who can think, and all of us can think, none of us can invent that. That takes an Isaac Newton. I mean, not invent it, discover it. But to actually understand them, we're all capable of understanding. People suddenly said, wait a minute. We can understand the world. The world's right there. We get it. And if we can understand the way things move around and the planets and all this stuff around us, if we can do science, right, then how come we don't get to decide what profession to have? How come we don't get to decide who rules over us, who our politicians are? How come we don't decide how we get to live? How come that's dictated from the top? If it turns out that we actually have a mind of our own and we can understand things, then why can't we be free? And the 17th century, what's the name of the 17th century? What's what we call it? The era of what? The age of enlightenment or the age of reason? We call it the age of reason, enlightenment. Because people discovered reason and embraced reason and embraced science. We call it the age of science. And with that, they discovered that they as individuals could know the world. And by the time we get to 1776, they're ready to declare that they can live their own life without philosopher kings. And that their life is worth living for its own sake. Not for the sake of the group, not for the sake of other people. Because they, once you realize that you can actually figure stuff out, you don't need to cheat off of your neighbor's tests thing, right? It gives you huge power over your own life. When you think, if you think, I don't know anything, it's all useless, then what do you look for? When we diminish knowledge and we diminish the mind, what do we look for? Where do we get comfort? From other people. Maybe they know something. I don't know anything. I'm just too stupid. So we look for other people to tell us what to do and how to live. So the fundamental idea behind America is the idea that every individual has the capacity to take care of himself. Every individual has the capacity to reason and to think. And as a consequence, every individual must be left free to use that capacity. And that the role of government is not to rule us. It's not to tell us what to do and how to do it, because nobody can tell you how to live. Only you can decide how to live your life. The role of government is to protect us. Because there are always going to be bad people who are going to try to get in our way, steal our stuff, defraud us. There's always going to be a Bernie Madoff in the group, right? And instead of us running around with guns on our hips to protect ourselves, it's much more efficient to have the police do it. And we want clear definition of property rights, and we need a government to do those things, a few things, those few things that protect us and make it possible for us to do what? To be free, to think for ourselves, to produce, to create, to build. That's what America was, that's the principle in which America was founded. It's the principle of individualism, the primacy of the individual, the sanctity of the individual and the individual's mind, because it rests on the idea of reason, the idea, the fundamental idea that we all have this capacity. And amazing things happened once America was founded. I mean, it's truly stunning. Unfortunately, nobody teaches this history anyway in our schools, but it's truly stunning what happened. Not just in America, but across the world, because everybody emulated us, or a lot of people emulated us and learned from us. What happens when you free people up? What happens when you free the human mind? What happens when people start taking their own life seriously and don't perceive themselves just as a piece in a swarm, in a collective, but actually as individuals? Massive amounts of wealth get created. People produce, people create, people build. So if you look at a graph, there's a famous graph of wealth per capita or income per capita. Either way, it doesn't really matter. You can start it 10,000 years ago. We'll start it here. I'm going to draw it in the air, right? 10,000 years ago. It's about somewhere under $3 a day. Imagine living on $3 a day. But that's what they lived on in today's dollars. 95% of the population, 10,000 years ago. And this is what happened over the 10,000 years. Nothing. Nothing happened. Yeah, it went up a little bit during Rome, and then it went down a little bit during the Dark Ages, and nothing happened. And then suddenly, it went like that. I mean, I have to go on my tiptoes, because it went really high. And maybe in Asia, it continued to go like this for a little while longer, and then it went like that. What's the date when it went like that? What's the inflection point when it suddenly starts going up?
1800.
1800 is not a bad. I have a preferred date, but it's somewhat random, right? I like 1776. But for two reasons. One, the symbolic reason, but I don't think it's symbolic. I think it's causal. It's the ideas of the Enlightenment, the ideas of individualism, the ideas of reason became prevalent. And as a consequence, freedom became prevalent, at least in the West. And that's what happened. Something else happened in 1776. A famous book was published. What do you know what book was published in 1776?
Wealth of Nations.
Adam Smith, The Wealth of Nations. So even in the field of economics, people now understood that if you leave people free, if you don't control and regulate and try to plan everything for them, just leave them free and protect them and establish private property. That's what happens. And he wrote the book, and it happened. And yeah, it took, I don't know, it took Asia another 200 years to figure that out. But they're starting to figure it out. They haven't quite got it completely yet. And they benefit from the fact that we've created a lot of wealth and capital since then. And if you look at that inflection point, when did that happen? In Asia. Not that long ago. Right? That's somewhere around... You know, it depends on the country. China, 1979. South Korea, a little earlier. Taiwan, a little earlier. India, a little later. 1991, probably. But basically, when they tilted, not a lot, a little bit maybe, towards respect for the individual, respect for individual freedom, respect for the individual mind, and less collectivism. And as soon as they did that, they didn't even do a lot of it, just a little bit of it. Bam! Massive amounts of wealth, prosperity are created. Over the last 30 years, between 1 to 2 billion people, billion, have come out of poverty in the world. That's the most underreported story, you know, ever, I think. That should be reason to celebrate in the streets, and yet we're all depressed. Right? 1 to 2 billion people have come out of poverty. I said 10,000 years ago, 10,000 years, 95% of people lived $3 a day or less. 300 years ago, what was the number? Also about 95%. Nothing much had changed. What's the number today? How many people in the world today? Today we have 8 billion people. Back then we had about 500 million, maybe 300 years ago. 8 billion people. What percentage of those people live under $3 a day today?
It's about 8. Just 30 years ago, it was over 20. So a little bit of freedom, a little bit of individualism, a little bit of respect for the individual over the group. And wow, life becomes much better for everybody involved. And yet, we seem to be living in times where there's little respect for the individual, qua individual. Where there's little respect for your ability to take care of your own life. Where people want to dictate what you do, even what you say on some American campuses. What you think. There's some things that are just unthinkable, it turns out. Like, where people want to tell you how to run your business, that's certainly in every aspect of that business. How much to pay your employees, what kind of deal you can cut with them, what you can't, how to treat your suppliers, and every aspect of the business world. Somebody wants to have a say over what you do. Why? Because they don't trust you. You don't have what it takes, or your employees don't have what it takes, or somebody in the transaction. What we've lost over 200 years is any respect for the individuals and an individual's mind. Indeed, philosophers today, there's no philosophers defending reason in American universities today. I don't know, the latest big thing at universities, less so in philosophy departments, but certainly in English and in many of the other disciplines, is something called, I don't know if you've heard of it, postmodernism. What does postmodernism teach us? Anybody hear postmodernism? No? You guys are way out here in Minnesota. You are so lucky. Postmodernism is probably the most prevalent intellectual ideas today on campuses. What do they teach us? They teach us that there is no truth. Anybody hear about the post-truth era, politically, that we've just entered? And that's where it comes from. So there's no truth. All of us perceptions. All of us have different perceptions. We each have our own truth. There is no reason, because there is no real reality. Reality is kind of in flux. We make it up as we go along. The world doesn't really exist, and we don't have the tools to know it, even if it did. I mean, this sounds weird, but this is, particularly the Midwesterners, it sounds weird, but because you guys have a core common sense that a lot of people don't. But this is what people believe. And therefore, you can't take care of yourself. You don't know what's right. You don't know what's good. You don't know what's just. You don't know what's moral. You don't know what reality is, even. And what do you need, therefore? You need a bunch of experts to tell you. You need the philosopher kings of Plato. Now, postmodernism is even worse than Plato, because Plato at least believed there's some truth somewhere. These people believe there's no truth anywhere to be found. So all it is about power. So today we have, we have truth depending on the ethnic group you believe in, that you belong to, right? So it's all about groups today, which groups you have. Anybody heard of intersectionality? Oh, good. No, it's healthy that you haven't heard of this crap. Intersectionality is the big thing now on campuses. It actually has a whole diagram of oppression. So since there's no truth, and there really is no reality, all there is human relationships. And human relationships are based on power. Who has power over whom? And who's better than whom? And who has, have you heard of the term privilege? You've heard of privilege. Everybody's talking about privilege, right? So who has privilege and who doesn't? And you can rank them, right? You can rank them. And some people are the most oppressed by definition, right? They're the most oppressed, and some people are pure privilege, right? I hate to break this to you guys in this room, just looking. Most of you are like up here. You're like the exploiters. You're the privileged. you know, you should feel really, 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 really guilty. Okay. Now, if you're female, you're slightly better because you're one rung down because you're being oppressed by the males in this room, by definition.
Right.
And it continues like this, right? So who's at the bottom? Who's like everybody owes them, right? Because this is a pyramid of who owes what. Who? Yeah, if you're indigenous, but today it's even more expansive than that, right? Because today it's if you're transsexual indigenous. Right? So it's not about treating them as equal. That's not the discussion. It's not about treating them as individuals, which I am all for, right? I'm nothing against any of those groups. It's not the issue. It's about them being a group that deserves extra. Because we, as a group, somehow got extra, unjustly, in some way. It's all about your group membership. It has nothing to do with you as an individual, and maybe the struggles you've gone through in life. Or maybe some people are privileged. There are a lot of cronies, you know, they get all kind of goodies out there. And our privilege. But this is about just your group membership. This has nothing to do with your particular circumstances as an individual. We've elevated our groups above anything else. And our president does the same thing. So that's on the kind of radical left, if you will. But we're doing it the same thing on the radical right. Make America great again. What does that mean? What America? The America of individualism? I don't see any, in the politics of today, I don't see much individualism or advocacy for individualistic policies. I see a lot of talk about group rights. I see a lot of talk about, it drives me nuts when I hear about American jobs. What the hell does American jobs? You have a job, and I have a job, and you might not have a job. Go find one, right? But America doesn't have jobs. Or trade. I love trade. Trade is great. America doesn't trade with China. I know that's a shock, but America doesn't trade with China. I trade with China, and we don't really trade with China. We trade with a Chinese guy. Who happens to be, you know, who's making t-shirts and who happens to live in China and be making them. And you're probably using as an intermediary for the trade Walmart or someplace like that, right? And you go to the store and you buy something and that store pays some Chinese company. What is it the government's business where I buy my stuff? Why is it anybody's business where I buy my stuff and who happens to make it? Unless there's some crime involved, which I'm not aware of. Why is it anybody's business? Who I employ, what I buy, where I buy it, from whom I buy it. And yet, this is supposed to be the issues of the day. This is really, really important. But it's because we think about these things as this nation trades with that nation. But no, we're just individuals. Buying stuff at Walmart or the local grocery store or the technology store. Where's this made? Anybody know where this is made?
Korea,
Taiwan, anybody else?
I think soon in Wisconsin.
What's that?
I said it in Wisconsin soon.
Wisconsin soon, yeah. All those jobs will come back, yeah. Hold your breath. Where's this made? I think it's something like 30 different countries. 30 different countries. Who the hell cares? It's beautiful. It's cool. It's made my life better. It's probably made your life better. If it hasn't, throw it away. Right? 30 different countries. People all over the world have worked on this. Isn't that amazing? Right? Talented people all over the world have built this. And they all got paid. They all got paid. None of them were slave laborers. They all got compensated for their time and their ability and their efforts. It's a beautiful thing. And yet, we're supposed to resent it. because it wasn't made in America. It was designed in America. It was invented in America. But who cares? Because we now, because reason has been denigrated in our society for years. I mean, kids today, we don't spend a huge amount of time teaching them how to think. What do we spend a lot of time asking them to do? Well, we got some kids here, but I'm afraid of what they're gonna say. They might not say what I want them to say. What do we spend a lot of time teaching kids what to do? Well, we tell them what not to do, suddenly.
Memorize.
Well, there's too much memorization, I agree, but that's not the worst of it. I think actually memorization's not that bad. What's that?
Obedience.
Obedience, yeah, maybe. I'm not convinced of that. What's that? Yeah, you guys haven't attended school in a long time. I don't know, when I go to colleges, when I go to universities, what kids are really good at is feeling. They're really good at emotions. We sit 8, 9, 10 year olds around in a circle and ask them what they think about politics. You know what 8, 9, 10 year olds think about politics? Nothing. How? They don't know anything about life. Why would they have any thoughts about politics? And why should we care about what they think about politics? All they're conveying is their emotions. So, you know, you can't, at the top schools, at the Ivy League schools today, you can't say something that people find offensive. Well, how do you learn anything if you can't offend somebody? You know what we have, the First Amendment? So we can speak niceties to one another, right? If all, you don't need to protect niceties. Right? What was the Declaration of Independence if not an offensive document? They wrote it to offend the King of England. I mean, read it. I mean, if you were the king, you would be offended. The whole point of the First Amendment is to protect our right to offend people. And indeed, every truth ever discovered in human history has offended somebody, the people who held the false belief. Before Uber offends taxi drivers. Any innovation offends the people who are entrenched in the old beliefs. The only reason to have free speech is to protect our ability to speak. Sometimes to speak things that are offensive. That's the point. That's how you discover truth. Now, true, a lot of stuff that's said is false and is offensive. But who gets to decide? That's the other thing American Revolution was about. Who gets to decide what is true and what is false? The king? The government? The authorities? Who gets to decide? The individual. You get to decide. You don't like, you think that's false and offensive? Turn your back and walk the other way. You don't have to listen to it. Or argue against it. Present facts that contradict what they said. But only the individual is responsible for what is true and what is not. Not authorities. That's what we rebelled against, was the idea of authorities telling us what's true and what's false. Isaac Newton, your formulas you think are correct, show me. Prove it to me. Isaac Newton's theory is correct not because my physics teacher said so, but because I understood, hopefully, the physics. And yeah, it works, actually. We know it works because we've created a bunch of stuff based on it, right? And it works. So when we denigrate reason and elevate emotion, we denigrate the individual and elevate the group by default. When we're just feeling beings walking around, we can't discover truth, we can't discover knowledge, we're bewildered. And when we're bewildered, we look for the safety and comfort of a group, of a collective. And that's where this country's heading towards, unfortunately, in the whole world. I mean, I travel a lot all over the world, and all I see are tribes that are fighting one another, tribes that hate each other's guts for no reason. I mean, reasons that have to do with like 1,000 years ago, what they did to each other. Who cares? And all I see is us reverting backwards, away from the Declaration of Independence, away from what America represents, back to a much darker age, an age of little groups all fighting with one another, all being ruled by some authority who, you know, why does the authority want us to fight with one another? Why do kings always go to war? Authoritarian regimes always, always start wars. Why? Divert your attention. So that, you know, the North Koreans don't revolt against their leader because they've got a much bigger enemy, the United States of America, they believe is about to kill them all. Because their propaganda has been saying this over and over again. You need a bigger enemy than you. So dictators love wars. It helps them consolidate power, and it helps them distract the people's attention to something else. So we seem to be moving away, or we are moving away from the concept of the individual to the concept of the collective, where everything is based on what's good for the group. Now, more and more in America, we talk about the public interest, the common good. I don't know, when I hear the public interest, I run. Because what's the public interest? Like, what's the interest of this group? Never mind the public, which is much bigger. What's the interest of this group? I don't know. Hard to tell. We could vote, right? What happens when you vote? The interests of the majority overwhelm the interests of the minority. So we get somebody's interest, but we don't get the public interest. Not everybody's going to be happy. Some people are not. There is no such thing as a public interest. What is there? There's no such thing as a collective good. There's no such thing as a common good. What is there? There's my good and your good and your good and your good, each one of us. And the only thing that you could say is common good, is to leave us free to go pursue our individual good. And some of us might be right. Some of us might be pursuing stupid things. Somebody might be pursuing good things. Okay, they're responsibility for their own life. But when we start imposing a common good on all of us, so-called common good, or what the majority wants on all of us, we get into trouble. You know, one of the sacred concepts that you're not allowed to talk against is democracy. Democracy is supposed to be a reflection of this common good. Well, I have some qualms about democracy. Because democracy is the imposition of the majority rule over the minority. And what's the smallest minority? We love to talk about group rights, minority rights. What's the smallest minority? The individual. Each one of you is a minority. Smaller than any minority that the government recognizes. Because you're just one. And when the majority imposes their will on you, you've lost freedom. Founding fathers were not pro-democracy. Or at least not the conception of democracy that says majority rule. Whatever. This is why we have a Bill of Rights. You can all decide that I should be silenced, but all you can do about it is walk out. You can't actually silence me. 99% of Americans decide I should be silenced. And my guess is if they voted, they would vote that way. But they can't. At least if we had a decent Supreme Court, they wouldn't uphold it because we have a Bill of Rights. Our founders understood that you cannot and never should impose the will of the majority over the individual. The role of government is not to tell us how to live. The role of government is to protect us, period. So yeah, we can vote for our politicians, but in the in a proper government, how much power do politicians have? Very little. That's the beauty of the American Constitution and Declaration, that gives politicians very little power. And we've had to move away from that Constitution in order to get to where we are today, where they have a huge amount of power. In the name of, always in the name of, the common good and the public interest. Everything Hitler did, he did for the common good and the public interest. Everything Stalin and Mao and everybody does is always in the common good and the public interest. I'm not interested in the common good and the public interest. I am interested in the individual, in individual rights. So I hope that as this country is sliding towards greater and greater collectivism, greater and greater tribalism, and I think as a consequence, greater and greater authoritarianism, which is where we're going, that we can instigate a new American revolution. But first we have to understand what the original one was about. So, you know, I hope you join me in helping educate our fellow Americans on the idea that the American Revolution was about individualism. It was about leaving the individual alone to live his life, free to live his life. Because that's the only antidote to the problems, the political problems we face today, to the existential problems we face today, is a renewed respect for the individual. And to do that, we must have a renewed respect for reason, for the human mind. Thank you.
Time for questions and answers of Dr. Brook. Does anybody have a question?
It's always toughest. The first question is always the toughest. Afterwards, it gets easier.
Over the weekend, I read your book, Equality is Unfair.
Equal is unfair.
Yes.
I mean, Equality is Unfair. I thought it was an outstanding book.
Thank you. Thank you.
And it's a point of view that just never gets discussed, and or on the news or whatever.
Yep.
But inequality really made America great.
Yes.
And it just speaks to that.
Yeah.
I thought it was just outstanding.
Yeah. So there's, we have this notion again, this false notion I think about what equality means, because in our Declaration of Independence, it actually says all men are created equal. Now put aside the contradiction of slavery, which is a horrible contradiction that the founders unfortunately compromised about. But what does it mean to say all men are created equal? Now, in the modern sense, we believe that that means that we should all have some kind of equal outcome. Or some kind of even, if you're conservative, then you say, oh no, I don't believe in equal outcome. I just believe in equal opportunities. But opportunity is just another outcome. I mean, there is no such thing as equal opportunities. I mean, I've worked very hard and tried to make as much money as I can so my kids have more opportunities than if I hadn't worked very hard. Right? I'm trying to maximize my kids' opportunities. I'm sure you guys are too. We don't believe in equal opportunities. We shouldn't. So why did the founders say equal? All men are created equal. Well, we've lost the sense of equality they meant. What they meant was equality of rights, equality of liberty, equality of freedom. You could have exchanged that term to say all men are created free. That's what they meant by it. They couldn't conceive that all men are going to have the same outcome. Look around the room. We're all different. I mean, that's beautiful and great. If we were all the same, it would suck. Even if everybody's like me, it would really be boring. We're all different. And guess what happens? When you take a bunch of different people and you give them equal rights, and you give them equal liberties, equality before the law, in other words, you set them free, what happens?
Some people rise up and the other people won't do anything with it.
Yeah, some people. But do anything with it is even not the right way to think about it. We're all going to do different things with what we have. Life's not about money, right? So the fact that some people are going to make a lot of money, how do you make a lot of money, by the way? What's the only way to make a lot of money in a free market?
Create values.
And who's going to benefit from those values? Other people. Right? The only way to make a lot of money is to create something that other people are willing to buy freely, voluntarily, of their own choice, because it'll make their lives better, for a price that's higher than what it costs you to produce it. Right? This is business 101. The only way to become a billionaire is to make hundreds of millions of people's lives better. It's the only way. Because they have to buy, hundreds of millions of people have to buy your product. And if they bought their product, why would, how much, if I buy this for $600, how much is it worth to me? No, it's not worth $600. Wouldn't have bothered if it was just $600. More than $600. So is my life better or worse when I bought this?
Better.
But note that inequality increased. Inequality increased because I'm $600 poorer, and Apple is $600 richer. So inequality, based on economists and how they measure stuff, has just increased. But I'm better off for having $600 less in my bank account because I have this. But you can't measure that. How do you measure that? So when you leave people free, they become unequal. Great. Because somebody creates the iPhone, which makes my life better. So what if they're richer? I got a PhD in finance. I could have gone to Wall Street. Made millions of dollars. But you know what? This, what we're doing right now, is worth more to me than millions of dollars. I'm a teacher. I'm not a, you know, trading guy. I love finance, and I've got a book defending financiers. But I'm not, that's not what really gets me, right? And I'm willing, literally, I have given up millions of dollars to do this. Because life's not about money. Life's about happiness. Life's about flourishing. Life's about success. And again, when you leave people free, they're unequal. Because we're different. That's just reality. And what is the only way to make us the same? What's the only way to make us the same? Like, I'm really upset. I'm really upset at basketball inequality. Right? LeBron James is a much better player than me. I mean, much better. I wouldn't score basketball. I'm upset. I don't like that. I want basketball equality. So how do we make me and LeBron equal?
Change the rules.
Break his legs.
Yeah, you break his legs. You get to break his legs.
Yeah.
And I like to say, even if you broke LeBron James' legs, you'd probably beat me. You'd probably have to break one of his arms. Now, we laugh, but that's the reality of every single day. Because when we redistribute wealth, we're breaking people's legs. Now, I live in California, luckily for me, right? At least for now. I pay 55% of my income in taxes. Somewhere between 50 and 55% of every dollar I earn goes to the government. Now, if you gave me a choice, we'll break your legs once a year or we'll take 55% of your income once a year, I'm not sure which one I take. Legs can be fixed. That money's gone forever. I'll never see it again. You know, if I really exploit Medicare, maybe I'll see a little bit of it back. It's gone. And what is money? What does money represent? When you earn it, what does it represent? Your effort, your time, your life. Money is life. I mean, yeah, we've got a negative perception of money for all kinds of weird reasons. But the fact is, when you earn money, it's because you have spent hours, life, time, and effort, and your best effort in making that money. And then somebody decides they're taking 50% of it. I mean, that's as evil as breaking people's legs. Maybe more evil than that. But we all understand you can't break LeBron James's legs. That's just wrong. But you can take a businessman's earnings, you can take the worker's earnings, you can just take them. And however much the majority votes to take, so be it. Right. They're debating right now whether the top marginal rate should go up to 42%, or whether it should go down to 35%. Really? Those are the choices? You're going to take a third of my life or half of my life? That's the choice? Nobody's talking about lowering to where it should be, as close to zero as possible. So the only way to make free, unequal people equal is by breaking legs. In other words, the only way is to use force. The only way is to violate the equality that the founding fathers stood for. To make some people less free because you're stealing and taking their stuff. It's the only way to do it. So I'm for equality of liberty, of freedom. I'm for freedom. And if you're for freedom, you can't be for equality of outcome or opportunity. And, you know, the book goes into a lot more detail, but that's basically the story. Any other questions?
Yeah. So the national media and the news, for the most part, are witnessing something, and they're giving their perspective and telling us what we should think.
Yeah.
How come there's not more of that from the individualistic viewpoint? It's always the group thing, it feels like.
We don't exist. Well, because the individualistic perspective is, you know, is not promoted, it's not respected, it's not out there, right? It just doesn't exist out there. It's been so many years, I'd say 100+ years, infiltrated with philosophical ideas that are collectivistic, that are anti-American, that are anti-individualistic, and that we have succumbed. And you very, very rarely see it. Now, the American spirit is still there. You still see it periodically. But as a society, we've become more and more collectivistic. And we want to be told, look, one of the things that you notice with this last election is how tribal we become, right? So this creepy monster, this Harvey Weinstein, right, does these horrible things with women. And the immediate response is, he's a lefty. Who cares? Who cares if he's a lefty or righty or middle? I mean, politics, what's he got to do with politics? He's a horrible human being. And there goes Hannity, right? Hannity, condemning this guy, and he's a lefty, and he's horrible. Roger Ailes, Hannity's former boss, did exactly the same thing as Weinstein. Hannity defended him to the end. Because it's all politics. It has nothing to do with actual individual behavior. It's about their team and my team, right? I'm a Boston Celtics fan. If you play for Cleveland, you're just damn evil, and that's it. Now, if you leave Cleveland and come to Celtics, like Irving just did, right, then you become a good guy. So, but it's just mind-boggling to me that we've taken a story that should be about men in power abusing that power and exploiting women in a horrible way, and maybe the prevalence of this kind of phenomena in our culture, and we've turned it into these on the left and these guys on the right. But everything now is like that. All of our media is now an echo chamber. Everybody's talking to each other, right? The people on the right are talking to one another, people on the left are talking to one another. But you see, I don't consider myself on the right anymore, right? Because to me, the right has become just like the left. They're all collectivists. And to me, the political spectrum today is collectivism, pretty much everybody, and me over here. Right? You know, maybe a dozen other people. But, so I don't even have the vocabulary to describe the nuttiness that I think is going on now, because I look at both political parties, they see, you know, the founding fathers wouldn't recognize the country based on that. And remember, the founding fathers didn't even want political parties originally. They railed against, because they didn't want that groupthink. What they wanted was every individual candidate to run on his own merit. And you remember the person who came in second in the presidential election became the vice president, because there were no parties. And then, you know, of course, Jefferson won, and he decided that he didn't like, what's his name, Burr. And because he was on the other side, and then he deteriorated into the parties very quickly. But the mentality right now is completely groupthink and completely focused on them versus us. But it's us. It's not my particular, you know, it's not my ideas. It's our ideas. It's all in terms of the collective. And that's why I see this country, you know, descending into tribalism. It's horrible. Because I mean, I left Israel. The main reason I left Israel is because I hate tribalism. And, you know, as much as I love Israel, and I love, but, you know, everybody in Israel believes that they're your family member. Like, it's one big happy tribe. So everybody's in your business. Everybody's in your life. Everybody thinks that they have a say in what and how you do stuff. And the beauty in America is, you want to be best friends with your neighbor next door? Great. You don't want to ever talk to them? Great. Nobody cares. You get to decide how close you get to people or not. There's not this expectation that everybody gets along all the time. And it's in Israel, it's very, you know, groupthink, very groupthink. You belong to the tribe, you're supposed to sacrifice to the tribe, you're supposed to jump on the grenade immediately for the tribe. It's that kind of collectivism ingrained, and I thought I left that. Maybe it's me who brought it here, but you know, but now I see it here, and of course, the Middle East is full of it, right? It's full of it. So, yeah.
It seems like with the founding fathers, many of them were people of means, but they also sacrificed a lot. A lot of them didn't fare so well after 1776.
Yeah.
Many of them, their livelihoods were affected and so forth. But
a few of them leave the home.
Yeah, and yet, but they had a statement. They were making a statement, not only for the public, but beyond. They had a vision of where they wanted to take, or at least see where society would go. And it's an amazing document when you think about it.
I know. I think the Declaration of Independence is the greatest, most important political document in human history, by far. I don't think anything comes close, not the Magna Carta, and not even the Constitution. I think it's the Declaration that is important. And at the end of the Declaration, they say, you know, we pledge our property, our honor, and our lives. Because they knew, like, it was 90% they were going to lose the war, right? They were fighting the mightiest military force the world had ever known, the British Empire. And they were probably going to lose, and they're probably all going to die. And yet they fought. Why? Because they valued freedom. They valued individual freedom. And they said, we will not live as serfs. We will only, if we're going to live, we're going to live as free men. And that spirit, I mean, think about what they did. And think about what we do, right? You know, life's easy. Life's pretty cool. And their revolution is disappearing. And what are we doing to fight for it? What are we doing to bring it back? Nothing. Or very little. As compared to what they did. So, for them, life without freedom wasn't worth living. So, they were fighting for themselves. For themselves, the people they loved. They wanted freedom in their lifetime. They wanted to see it. And we're letting it slip away. Sad.
What do you think has catalyzed the shift away from individualism? Is it the profitability of the tribalism, or is it the absence of it that was created?
Now, I think it's the absence of a proper defense of reason. So I think it's all driven by your view of the human mind. So during the Enlightenment, there was this brief period, about 100 years maybe less, where the human mind was venerated, and philosophers venerated the human mind. And then came a couple of philosophers, one French, one German. All bad things come from primarily Germany. Rousseau was the French, and the German was Kant. And Kant was this brilliant philosopher, the greatest philosopher of his time. And he basically said, you can't know reality. Reality is unknowable. Our senses and our mind distort everything we see. And we all think we see the same thing because we all have the same kind of categories in our mind that shape our viewing of reality. But we have no clue what reality is really like. And for a variety of reasons that have to do with some of the weakness of the case the Enlightenment made, that took off. That became the dominant. And then you had Kant, and then you had Hegel. Hegel says, contradictions, they're just part of reality. Everything's a contradiction. Contradictions are wonderful. We should embrace contradictions, which is basically rejecting logic, rejecting science, rejecting reality, because the whole idea of logic is to figure out, you know, if you see a contradiction, to figure out why it's not a contradiction. As Aristotle said, A is A. A cannot be A and non-A at the same time. Right? That's basic laws of logic. And yet, Hegel says, no, contradictions are wonderful. And for whatever reason, you know, Europe embraced that philosophy, and then you get Schopenhauer, and then you get Karl Marx, and then you get Nietzsche, and not accidentally, as a direct consequence, you get communism and fascism, because that's the ultimate outcome of those set of ideas. And America, so they had this perception of reality, and Kant's moral code, also a Frenchman, also articulates this, a guy named Augustine Comte, C-O-M-T-E. They say, look, in morality, what makes something good, what makes something moral, is if you do it for purely 100% selfless reasons. So if you help somebody out and you feel good as a consequence, so when you're going to help them, you think, oh, I'm going to feel good from this. So, charity's nice because it makes me feel good. It doesn't count. You have to be completely selfless, completely negate you. Think about that in comparison to the Declaration of Independence. We have an inalienable right to pursue your happiness, not other people's, yours. So you've got this, and Kant is very big on duty. You have to do what's moral because you have to do what's moral, and you know what's moral because you have these categorical imperatives. Right? And of course you don't, so somebody has to tell you what's moral, i.e. a Führer or somebody, right, has to tell you. So these philosophical ideas were in Europe, and I think ultimately led to the catastrophes of the 20th century. What happened in America? We had no intellectuals. To a large extent, Americans were too busy building the country. Like, if you were smart in America, you went into business, you didn't go in, you didn't become a professor. But we have the term in America, we say, you know, those who do, and those who can't do, teach, right? So, we never took intellectuals very seriously in America. We just didn't. So, we were too busy building this country, too busy going into business, taming the wilderness, whatever. So, when we became rich, and we wanted to send our kids to the best schools in the world, like in the late 19th century, where'd we send them? Germany and France. And they came back with those nasty European ideas. And when Princeton and Yale and Harvard wanted to become the best universities in the world, they had the money, because all these, all these people were showering them with money because they'd gone out and made money in business. Where did they go get their professors? Germany and France. And that's how our universities became bastions of these ideas which are fundamentally collectivistic. Europe has never went through, particularly Germany, never went through an individualistic phase. France a little bit during the 18th century with Voltaire and the encyclopedias, the Enlightenment France, and England certainly did. But the rest of Europe has always been collectivistic, right? The Europeans are so collectivistic, right? Think about this, right? You live in Spain, you live in this one corner in Spain, right, called Catalonia. You have to have your own Catalonian state, right? Because you're a little different. Your language is a little different. You have a little bit different customs. So you have to have your own country. I was in a place called Montenegro, which is a country of 600,000 people. And I said, why do you have a country? Oh, because we're Montenegros. I mean, how are you different than Serbs or Albanians or Bosnians? Oh, we're a different tribe. Like, why? How do you do that? Have you run genetic tests? I mean, it's so stupid and barbaric and primitive. What, Each one of us has to be with our own people who look exactly like us, who have the same heritage. It reminds me that in Iceland, you know, Iceland's a tiny little country, 250,000 people live in Iceland. And the population's never grown much because I guess it's so cold, they don't have a lot of kids. But 250,000 people in Iceland, so they have an app that you could put in, let's say you're dating somebody, you could put in their name into the app, and they will tell you whether they're a cousin of yours or not. I mean, you have to do that, because otherwise you could get real problems genetically, right? So they have to worry about that. But that's just, you know, we're going to stay in a little group, but not, I mean, but the world, Europe has always been like that. Like, World War I broke out because this tribe wanted to separate itself from that tribe, and millions of people died because of that. We had a war in Yugoslavia, the former Yugoslavia, right, between Bosnias, and even today they call it Bosnia-Herzegovina, right? /Herzegovina, God forbid, you know, you should be slighted because your tribe wasn't named in the name of the country. And they fought against the Serbs, who fought against the Croats, who fought against the Montenegrins, who fought against the Macedonians. Over what? Over ideas? Over anything important? No, over the right to be a Macedonian and proud of it. This is in America, right? We have Macedonians, and we have Italians, and we have Poles, and we have Jews, and we have Mexicans, and we have blacks, and we have people from all over the world. And the whole idea of America is, who cares? You're an individual. I don't care where you're from. I don't care what your ancestors did. I don't care what color skin you have. I don't care what religion you have. I don't care about any of those things. I care about you as an individual. You good guy or bad guy, that's all I care about. That's it. And that's why you can have a massive country with people as diverse as we have, until recently, I guess, peaceful. And now what the left is trying to do is break us into little tribes. And what the right is doing is saying, oh, you want to play that game? We can play that game too. We're white. And now you have this rise in white supremacists and white nationalists and white all this stuff, because they've learned the identity politics game from the left. But so we want to break ourselves into tribes. So fundamentally, this comes from the idea that individuals can't reason. It comes from philosophy. It comes from universities. It comes from the philosophers, the philosopher kings, if you will. They taught us this, and we have not resisted it. We have not fought back. And I think, I mean, I don't know how many of you here have read Ayn Rand, but I think Ayn Rand is an historically important figure here. Because in my view, Ayn Rand completes the revolution that was started in the Enlightenment. Ayn Rand is the first American philosopher. She is the first philosopher to articulate a philosophy consistent with the ideas of the Founding Fathers, consistent with the political system that is America. And the only way, I believe, to save America is for our intellectual classes one day to respect Ayn Rand and to teach Ayn Rand, and for those ideas to become prevalent. Because they're ideas of the Enlightenment. They're about individualism. They're about everything that implies. And the sad thing is that during the 20th century and into the 21st century, most of the smart people have turned their backs on her and either embraced those ideas or embraced other ideas that are much weaker in defending us against the ideas of collectivism that are rising up and bubbling up to the surface. Our philosophy matters. It's life or death. And you got to find the good philosophers and support them, because it's the only weapon we have. I mean, I tell my libertarian, free market, conservative friends, you can argue economics all day. I can show you how socialism doesn't work a million different ways, on a million different issues. I can take any one of these policies to govern and show you that it doesn't work. And prove it. I mean, real proof. And point at examples where it doesn't work. And nobody cares. Nobody cares about economics. They don't. They don't care about politics. People care about morality. People care about what they think is true, what they think is noble, what they think is just. And that the left dominates. We don't have a chance. We don't have a chance. It's the issue of equality, right? Equality is just. It doesn't work. We know it doesn't work, but it's just. So we have to have equality. It's not about economics. We won the economic debate. Those of us who believe in freedom won the economic debate 50, 60, 70 years ago. Certainly with the fall of the Berlin Wall, we won the debate. Doesn't matter. We're still losing. Because it's not about that. There were other questions. You had a question before.
Well, just coming back on the media thing, that do you think, like, when you think of right and left and the media, that aren't they just capitalizing on what they see? This group of consumers feeds off this. This group of consumers feeds off this. Therefore, I'm going to raise that news and make lots more money because of that. Yeah. Because
lost is journalism. Well, you've lost this objective truth, because actually, philosophically, nobody believes in objective truth. So if you don't believe in objective truth, what are you going to do? You're going to preach, you're going to do what gives you power, do what gives you money, which is preach to your choir, and manipulate emotions. It's not about facts anymore, it's about emotions. So you have the mainstream media, let's call them, who tend to be left, preaching to a leftist audience, and preaching that, but then you have Fox. You think the New York Times lies any more than Fox does?
No.
They're just lying from a different perspective. Breitbart, lying machine. Right? That's what you're getting. And what you're not getting is objective journalism, because nobody believes in objectivity anymore. We're in the post-truth era. We're in the fake. Everything is fake news, according to the pundits. Right? It just depends on which perspective you have on it. There's no objective reality. So I think they're all pandering. Once in a while, somebody in one of these medias will do a good story, like the New York Times broke the Weinstein story and did a really good write-up and interviewed people and got facts and they didn't just sensationally release it, right? And of course, Fox slams the mainstream media as, you knew this was going on along all the time, why didn't you reveal it before? Well, if Fox knew that, why didn't Fox do it? If everybody knew that Weinstein was doing this, why didn't Fox reveal it, right? Why didn't Breitbart reveal it? Breitbart was looking for dirt on Democratic donors. Because it's not that simple. If you're going to go after somebody, you better have your facts, because they'll sue you otherwise. New York Times got facts, and they did it, right? So I commend the New York Times for that. Most of the time, I think the New York Times is horrible. It's a rag, right? But so are all the rest. I find figuring out what the actual news is a challenge every single day. And I'm in this business, right? And I have to read multiple sources. If you're being quoted, I want to see the video, because I don't even trust them to quote you right. It's that bad. Now, 20 years ago, that wasn't the case. It's getting worse and worse and worse. And it goes back to this idea. If there's no objective reality, it's all about manipulating people. It's all about power. I can do whatever it takes. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if I misquote you, because what you said was just interpreted by different people different ways anyway, because there is no objective interpretation for what you say. This is postmodernism. We interpret texts in different ways from different perspectives. Depends on our genes and our heritage and the color of our skin. Right? There's female truth and male truth and black truth and Hispanic truth. And if you believe that, then yeah, then there should be Hispanic news and black news and female news and male news and Democratic news and Republican news, and that's what we're getting. We're getting exactly that. So we're getting everything that you would expect given the philosophy. And that's the real story. So, and the only way to challenge what's really going on is to challenge the philosophy. To fight for objective truth.
I think part of that is the result of apathy.
Yeah.
There's tremendous apathy in the American electorate. I don't know why that exists, or it had always existed, I'm not sure, because I don't know what it was like 50 years ago or 100 years ago. But there just seems to be an apathy towards learning more about your own government, your own people, your own culture.
Well, I think this.
Before we break, I have another follow-up.
Okay. I think it's always been around. But this is the point. It never used to matter that much. This is the beauty of the American system. we shouldn't have to care about politics that much. Because they shouldn't be that powerful. The only really important decision government makes is whether to go to war now. And even that's a hard decision for them in the original conception of the American government, because there was no standing army. Right? So they had to raise an army to go to war. So if you didn't like the war, you said, to hell with you, I'm not joining. Right? And if not enough people joined, they didn't go to war. So historically, the whole way the American system was built was for us not to care about government. Because what should we care about? Our lives. You know, a farm, a factory, a work, a children, a family, doing the things that are necessary to live. And yeah, they had to pass some laws about property, and maybe they, you know, the police had to be fair and stuff like that. But okay, those are minor, relatively speaking, minor issues. War was a big deal, but that was it. And this country's made a lot of mistakes when it comes to war. And a lot of people died for no reason because of that. But that's almost all in the 20th century. Once government got really big and really powerful. Now we should care, because they're in our lives. They dictate everything that we do. But we're too busy living our lives. And I think that's a virtue of Americans. I go other places in Europe and places like that, they're obsessed with politics. And I find that repulsive, right? Americans are obsessed with living. That's great. Politics is not living, exactly. Our politician friend left, so we can say this. You had one of your representatives here. It's about, America's about an individual living his life in pursuit of his own happiness. And yeah, there are politicians up there. So I think it was a virtue originally. Now it's a vice. I also think it's a lack of leadership. We're not taught. We're not encouraged to participate. And at this point, it's so despicable. It's so horrible. I mean, when they lie, I mean, one of the things that makes Donald Trump unique is that all politicians lie. But Donald Trump relishes it. It's like, yeah, I lied. Why are you surprised? Right? So I promised that, and I'm going to do something else. What difference does it make? I mean, other politicians kind of justify it, and they put themselves into a pretzel trying to explain why they lied. But he kind of said, yeah, okay, you know, I need to get elected, right? So I said the Mexicans will build the wall, right? They pay for the wall. And they're not going to pay for the wall. So I lied, beat them. We're at that point where we're willing to accept that. And of course, the people who voted for him, like, I mean, not everybody, but a certain portion of it, anything he does is great. And the people who hate him, everything he does is evil. I'm more close to those guys, but it's you look at politics. I used to go to Washington a lot. I used to do these seminars for congressional staffers who are very young and idealistic. So it's great. I love talking to them. And they used to take me. My staff used to take me to visit congressmen and senators. I've met a lot of senators and congressmen, and I did this like a couple of times. And I said I'm never doing it again. I don't like these people. They're not interesting. They're not particularly smart. They are dealing with minutia. They don't care about ideas. They're not people you would want to hang out with. So why should we care? I mean, we have no choice. I guess we have to elect them. But then just leave us alone. That's the healthy attitude in America. But yeah, we need to get involved. We need to care. Because it's getting to the point where they're destroying our lives, or they're at least trying to. You had a question?
Yeah, is technology, the internet, smartphones, social media, is that going to move us? More knowledge, is that maybe going to shift things? You think education, knowledge is going to help?
Angry Birds, in answer to your... So I actually was having an argument yesterday with somebody who said, and there's a prevalent view among certain free market thinkers, that technology is going to save us. And the idea is that technology is advancing so fast, or has the potential to advance so fast. We're just at the beginning. It really is. There's a whole singularity university in Silicon Valley. There's the whole idea that we're just at the point where this is going to take off. We're going to be living to 150, 200 years soon. You know, big data and AI and robots are going to be able to do all these things, and it's just going to be. And the government won't be able to keep up. They just won't have the tools. So we'll be able to hide our money with cryptocurrency. We'll be able to hide our activities. They won't even know it. And we'll basically be free because they won't be able to catch us. I'm a skeptic. Right? I don't think those people appreciate it. Now, I believe in technology, and I believe that if we were free, the potential that is being unleashed right now technologically is unbelievable. Like just in biology, just the stuff that they know about the cell and what they can do with gene splicing, and you know, we could live, I think, to be 150, 200 years old if we didn't have an FDA. Given that we have an FDA, you know, 90 is going to be stretching it because they're trying to kill us as much as fast as they can because you're expensive after a certain age, right? So they don't want you. This is a side note, but George Bush had a special committee appointed to study life extension and whether this was a good thing. That's strange to me, right? But they did. They studied this, and a very well-known guy whose name escapes me, but he works at the American Enterprise Institute, was in charge of this. And they came back and said, no, it's not a good thing. We should not be investing in life extension. It's like, why? And they had all these reasons. And some of the reasons were things like, well, we can't afford it, so security will go bankrupt. It's like, people will retire at 65 if they're going to live to 200. We'll all want to work longer, right? And we'll be healthier and so on. So stupid stuff like that. And then they said, they had the thing that said, it will be the end of marriage, right? People, there'll be a lot more divorce. Why? I mean, it's okay to live with a woman for like 50, 60 years, but 200? So we'd have, I mean, even if that were true, right? I would love to live with my wife for 200 years, but even if that were true, right? Who cares? You get to live to be 200. I mean, so the divorce rate is more important than human life. It's just the whole thing. And these were conservatives, right? You're tinkering with nature. This is playing God. Yeah, that's what we do. We tinker with nature. We play God. That's the human race. Great. Isn't that cool that we can do that? So they had all these excuses why we can't live long. So technology is amazing. And the technology that's coming is amazing technology. I don't think in and of itself will solve the problem. I don't think it's about knowledge. I don't think it's about, put it differently. I don't think what technology gives us is knowledge. What technology gives us is information. Turning information into knowledge is hard. And it's a skill you need to learn and practice. And I think most people don't know how to do it they know how to do it in their job, in their work, in their business, but they don't know how to do it on these abstract, philosophical, political scale. And we don't have leaders who help us and teach us how to do it. So I think if anything, what I think a lot of us feel is we're overwhelmed by the amount of information. We get tons of information and from all different sources and all different types, and we don't know what to do with it. I mean, I barely know what to do with it. And again, I'm a pro, right? This is my job and I don't know what to do with it. So my guess is it's doing the opposite. It's making people somewhat say, well, this is too much for me, I'm walking away. Or I'm gonna go join my group and just hear information I wanna hear. Right? I'll only listen to Fox News. I'll only listen to MSNBC, right? So people are looking to simplify. By simplifying, they're dumbing themselves down. So I don't think what we're gaining from technology is knowledge. I think what we're gaining is information. And we are all suffering from information overload, if any. All right, we'll end on that note. Thank you all.